Good afternoon and welcome to Weekly Sedition, the show dedicated to dissent and alternative lifestyles. This is Contra, your host, this and every Tuesday at noon, right here on 97.3 WRIR. It's Richmond Independent Radio, radio for the rest of us. Today I have a very special local guest with me. Richmond activist and filmmaker Jen Lawhorn is here to talk about her new documentary, Little Trip of a Dream, which will be screening at 7 p.m. tonight at Gallery 5. The film begins in a restaurant kitchen here in Richmond, where we meet Jen's co-workers, all of whom are undocumented workers from Mexico. From there, Jen heads south to the village of Ocotitlan, where many of these co-workers immigrated from. Through interviews and encounters with family and community members in Ocotitlan, and a visit to several points at the U.S.-Mexico border, Jen begins to understand her friends and their motivation for coming to the United States. I spoke to Jen yesterday and asked her to explain the impetus for documenting the trip.
At the beginning, the trip was a hitchhiking adventure for a friend and I. We traveled from Tijuana all the way down Baja and then along the Pacific coast of Mexico. And I brought my camera along with me mostly to record the stuff that we were doing. We were having fun. We also had a political idea of what we wanted to do. We were also going to go to Chiapas and work in solidarity with the Zapatistas down there. So I brought my camera, and I knew that if I brought it with me, something would come up that I knew I would have to record. So I was woofing, which is like a volunteer exchange on farms, and I saw that there was a woof farm in Topoztlan, which I recognized as being the village where my people were from, my Mexican coworkers were from. And I brought along pictures from people with the idea that, oh, if I happen to go there, I'll bring these pictures to them and I'll meet these people. So when I went to this farm, I started to go up to this village and to meet the people there, and I was very welcome. They were very open with me, and so afterwards, I just started. When I was there, I was just recording, and with the idea of, oh, I'll just record their village so they can see how it's changed, and I'll take it back and show it to them, and it'll be cool. But then later on, I was in Chiapas, Mexico, and I attended an immigration workshop, which helped me develop this radical analysis and better understand what was happening with immigration in Mexico, with the people going from Mexico to the U.S. So I saw that that's something that I was living, that I was experiencing right then and there, and I saw the responsibility to record it. So then it was at that point I decided to make this documentary.
Let's talk about Ocotitlan for a minute. And was there anything about the culture there that specifically struck you? So you're there, you're seeing the families and the homeland, essentially, of the people you'd become friends with, your co-workers here in Richmond. Was there anything about the culture and or the people that struck you that really you'd like to share at all?
I was really fortunate and blessed to meet them and to be so easily welcomed, and I think they were touched that someone from their loved one's world in the U.S. had come and was interested in seeing what their lives were like, and they fed me so well. they would specially prepare dishes for me. They wanted to make me tamales because I never had a homemade tamale, so they made me tamales. They let me stay there. They didn't know me from anywhere, but they really wanted me to come and hang out, and I think that was really important for them. So I would just sit around with ladies, and they would talk to me, and while they were cooking, and just hours and hours on time. And they're just such a social people and family oriented, and I never, beyond my own family, I hadn't really spent much time with other families. So everything was family oriented, and it also struck me how, although they had loved ones back home sending them money, that they were still living in a lot of poverty. They didn't have running water, no plumbing in their houses. They would have these houses built, but they would essentially be empty inside without any furniture. So it just made me realize how much work it was for them to build these houses, and then the money that it would take to fill them with furniture. But I just felt so blessed, and it just felt so, I don't know, magical to me to be there. And it was a beautiful place. It was high in the mountains, and there's just so much, so many trees and so much exploring to do. They would take me on trails and go hiking all the time, and I just I didn't expect to have such an authentic experience like that.
Now, I think you had told me before that the trip had started to not quite feel authentic at first because you were woofing on the organic farm there, which basically with a bunch of other Europeans, and you had begun to feel that the trip wasn't quite genuine yet.
Yeah, normally when I travel, I've traveled through Latin America before, and I found that a lot of those experiences are spent in hostels, and you're only meeting other European travelers, and that it's people that are privileged to do these trips but don't really realize how privileged they are, and they're like, you know, these like voyeurs that are looking at these ruins and traveling all over the world. So early on, I realized how false that experience was, essentially, or in my opinion, I feel like that's a false experience. So then I've done other trips where I've gone and worked and volunteered in solidarity with other organizations and trying to help and learn about other movements. So yeah, when I was at this wolf farm, they were living behind a wall, and they're all Europeans, and they were so isolated from the rest of Mexico, and I didn't like it at all. I didn't like what I was doing. We were all like vibing off each other, meditating and doing yoga and gardening all the time, and that was fun, but I got really tired of it very quickly, and so every chance I had that I could get off the farm, I would just go hitchhike up to the village and hang out with them, and I just saw that this farm was kind of pretty neo-colonial, and so I just didn't want to really have anything to do with it.
At one point in the film, it's mentioned that between 70 and 80 people from this village had migrated to the U.S., and this was filmed some time ago, so I imagine the numbers have gone up now, but could you talk about what the town looks like, as what the differences are between, you know, a town, what it might look like had, you know, this immigration not taken place, and what it looks like now with so many people gone?
Well, there's a couple different factors that you can relate to all this. In the film, I talk about how a highway was built in the 70s from Tepoztlan to the village, and I think it was at that point what facilitated the transport of people from high up in the mountains down into this village, Tepoztlan, that people started to get more Western ideas and more exposed to maybe a little more upward mobility as far as income. So then people started to get the idea of, oh, well, you know, we can make more money. So I think that my friends that I met here in Richmond, they're all in their 20s and 30s. They're probably the first generation of people in that village to migrate to the north. And in the film, it's mentioned that there's about 80 people there, but I've been told that it's double that amount, and that there's about 15 to 2,000 people that live in this village. So that's about a 10% chunk of the people, and it's mostly men that are up there. So you have lots of families without father figures, lots of women being left behind that are, you know, carrying on a household while they're getting money from the U.S., but it's still a lot of work that they're doing as well, where they probably want to have their partner with them, helping them with their household. So I think that I met mostly women there, and but the men I saw were older men that couldn't migrate. And I think that if the people hadn't migrated to the U.S., that I wouldn't see houses built from materials. They would still probably have wood shacks. They wouldn't have all the development that they were having. I mean, it was still pretty impoverished, and I'm not saying that they had like resort hotels built or anything there, but I mean, people building their houses out of cement blocks.
You were talking about families. You mentioned that a lot of the men are gone, and not just men, but some women have migrated as well. You have a couple of people in the film who you knew, or I guess still know, who had to leave their village and leave their daughters behind. And specifically, I want to talk about the story of Teresa and Rosa. And could you talk a little about the way that this migration has affected particular families mentioned in the film, and or not mentioned in the film, if you prefer?
Sure. In the film, it's mentioned that Rosa, when I interview her, that her mother left when she was two, and she didn't remember her. And I thought that was incredibly sad that a daughter and a mother didn't really know each other, that they had spent so much time apart. And now Rosa is probably about 11 years old. And in the meantime, Teresa has given birth to a son here in the U.S., so he's a U.S. citizen. And she has a daughter that's left behind in Mexico that can't join her. So she's torn between going back to her family and her daughter in Mexico or staying here in the U.S. for the benefit of her son, since she believes it's more of a privilege for him to grow up as a U.S. citizen than to go back to Mexico, unfortunately. So it's kind of a universal story. There are so many families like that that have left children behind that don't see their kids. Their kids don't know their parents, and that to me is incredibly sad, especially since I'm so close with my parents. I don't know what I would do if I had grown up without knowing my mom and dad. And with Francisco and Paola, Paola was about 6 months when Francisco left her, and then he came back and she was 6 or 7 years old, and she just refused to acknowledge him as her father or to believe that this man could have any sway on her life. So I think he was pretty bummed out about that. And I interview her mother, Maricruz, and she talks about that a little bit, and it was probably really hard for him to go down there and see that his daughter had grown up without him and really didn't want him to be a part of her life, you know.
I think, and this is in a culture in which family is considered one of the most important possible things. And the irony of the whole thing really is that the reason that these people had left their children, they never would have done it otherwise, was to make a better life for their children. I mean, they had to give them up in order to help them. So it's really kind of a sad part of the story. You mentioned the difficulty of obtaining visas in to get to America, and I wondered if you could talk a little about what some of the difficulties and complexities are involved in that. Even people who have, you know, pretty defined opinions about the immigration debate don't really often know what it takes to be able to come into the country. Could you talk a little about the conditions and you know, what happens with the visas?
The U.S. hasn't reformed its immigration policy in 2 decades, and every day at the U.S. Embassy in Mexico City, they have about 400 appointments for people to apply for a visa, and in order to get that appointment, every person has to pay $100 just to get an appointment. The $100 does not guarantee them to get a visa at all, and so out of those 400 people that they see every day, about 4 or 5 people get a visa. So, and then once you're rejected, you can't apply for a visa until a year later. So if you get rejected, you have to wait another year to apply for a visa. You also have to show that you have properties, that you have strong ties to Mexico or whatever country you're from that will force you to come back. So they want to see that you have a bank account with $2,000 in it, which is really hard for a lot of Mexicans to do. They want to see that you have properties. They want to see that you have a job to return home to. They want you to prove all this just to cross the border to get into the U.S. So a lot of people, I mean, they do show that you can have a degree in physics and have all this money, but they'll still deny you. And essentially, they're making, if there's 400 people and they're making $100 off every one of them, every day they're making $40,000 off of this process. So essentially, it's a racket.
So we're talking a little about the political side of things now. The film, the documentary, mostly focuses on the personal stories. I wanted to talk a little about one part in the film. You're talking about corn and the importance of corn, and you were talking about how they were always wanting to make you this homemade food. And the corn and beans have been a, you know, an integral part not just of the economy but of the culture for a long period of time. You mentioned in the film that it's becoming less and less a viable way of life as far as sustaining economically a family or a community. Let's talk about why that is.
The Mexican people are traditionally a farming people, so they've been sustaining themselves through the crops that they grow. And ever since the passage of the North American Free Trade Agreement in 1994, they've seen their way of life dramatically change. And what happened with the North American Free Trade Agreement, which is also called NAFTA, they saw that their economy had to be integrated or globalized with the U.S. and Canadian economies. So what they had to do was take away all the protections and subsidies that their government had been providing farming people in Mexico for decades, and in order to better facilitate the flow of goods between the U.S., Mexico, and Canada. And so one part of NAFTA was that Mexico had to take away its tariffs, which protected Mexican corn from U.S. corn. And so once they did that, and they also had to take away their subsidies, American or United States corn flooded their market, and the United States corn is subsidized by our government. So once all this corn got dumped into Mexico, it was a lot more cheaper than Mexican corn, and people can compete with that, so they can no longer grow their own corn, so all their fields went fallow. And then you saw that this tradition, this way of life of farming, they could no longer do that, so they were forced into a market competition to look for other kinds of work. So you saw a mass migration in Mexico itself from people going from the farmlands to urban centers to work, or if they couldn't find work in these urban centers, they had to find their way up north and cross the border into the U.S.
Talk about No Más Muertes. You spent a little time with a group called No Más Muertes, and there's some of that in the film. And talk a little about your experiences with this group, what they're about, and how your experiences were with them.
No Más Muertes, they're an organization that is based out of Tucson, Arizona, that I have tremendous respect and love for the work that they do. And I don't know for how long they've been doing this, but they've been setting up camps in the Arizona border area where volunteers come, and they go and travel out in the desert during the day. They do patrols, and they look for people in need of help. And they also leave water, or they carry shoes, socks, and food for people, because a lot of people, when they cross the border, they are completely unprepared, and they're lied to, and they're told that they're only going to be walking for maybe an hour or maybe a couple hours to get to Chicago, and so they don't have any idea what kind of experience they're about to have, and they're completely unprepared. And so the volunteers from No More Deaths, they go around and they look for people that are in need of help, and I walked around with them. I did a few patrols with them. I was with them for a few days, and we would find things that had been left behind, and we would find things like high heels. Women crossing the border wearing high heels, and they had no idea, and just shoes, things left behind, like children's shoes. That was really striking to me. And the summer that I went, it was one of the hottest summers on record, and people were dying. They were dropping like flies. By the time I went out there, which was in August, I think they recorded more than 300 deaths in the desert that summer. So No Más Muertes, they also record testimonies of people. They've recently released a report on abuse suffered by people, by border crossers, at the hands of Border Patrol agents. And I think everybody should read that. And while I was there that summer, actually, two activists from No More Deaths, I talk about this in the film, they were out on one of their patrols, and they came across somebody that was at the point of death, and they have doctors on hand that they call, and they told the doctor the symptoms of this man that they found, and the doctor said that they urgently had to get him to a hospital, and so they put him in their car and started to drive to Tucson, and it's about an hour drive to Tucson to save this man's life, and they got pulled over by the Border Patrol. And they were arrested and charged, which is a felony charge, with smuggling of human beings. And so there was a really long, drawn-out court battle that I think lasted a couple of years, where they were going to throw these people in jail for a long time for helping to save somebody's life. And I think they finally beat it, in 2007. So they're criminalized by the Border Patrol, by the U.S. government, for doing this humanitarian work that's essential.
Well, the film has its Richmond premiere tonight. Why don't you give people some information about where they can check that out if they're interested?
The Richmond premiere for the film is at 7 p.m. at Gallery 5, which is 200 West Marshall Street. Before that, at 6 o'clock, there's going to be a potluck, but we'll be showing the film at 7. I'm showing it to churches, to ESL classes, and really I just want to show this film to encourage discussion between people or amongst the community, for people to engage each other more, because as we're getting into harder times, immigrant people are unfortunately scapegoated for our problems, and there's lots of alarming things happening in a reaction to immigrant people. So I think we need to work better to strengthen our ties so that we can act in solidarity with them to support their communities when government repression or right-wing repression falls on them.
Jen, thank you so much for coming by to talk about your film.
Whoop whoop.
I wanted to cover one more story today, which you may have seen on the front page of the Richmond Times-Dispatch last week. Thursday the 4th was the final sentencing of the murderers of Talik Taliaferro, the young man who was killed by two cousins in Powhatan last year. For those of you not familiar with the case, it gained local and national attention when those two cousins, one of whom shot Talik and one of his friends with a rifle loaded with an 83-round drum of ammunition, had their charges inexplicably reduced from first-degree murder to involuntary manslaughter. The getaway driver was only convicted of misdemeanors. Because the defendants and 11 of the 12 jury members were white and the victims were black, this set off charges of racism in the court system, and the FBI has since begun an investigation into possible civil rights violations in the trial. The day before the sentencing, a rally for Talik was held here in Richmond. It was at the exact time of that gathering last Wednesday that the torrential thunderstorms struck the city. The rally went on anyway, and members of Talik's family and a number of supporters gathered to hear mostly religious messages of justice and retribution.
I think sometimes we feel conflicted as followers of faith to become angry. We feel as though in the name of being peacemakers, that is a calling for us to stand back and to be passive. But when I read the prophet Isaiah and when I hear the words of the Lord, I understand that my heart tonight feels what God feels.
Yeah, yeah.
I understand that the anger in my soul resonates with the anger in God's heart. For God looked out on the injustice and saw that no one was trying to do anything about it. So tonight I want to tell you, if you are a person of faith, if you are a follower, regardless of your religion or your background, if you are created by the same creator that spoke those words, it is our duty, it is our God-given responsibility, it is our calling to stand up for this family.
The rally ended with a chant familiar to social justice activists everywhere. The next day, I arrived at the courthouse to find it surrounded by state and local police. The earlier trial had been rather rowdy, with members of both families shouting at each other and at the court, and the authorities were concerned that there was a potential for a small riot. And there was one small altercation when one of Talik's friends began to follow the father of one of the shooters into the courtroom, claiming that he had muttered a racial slur as he passed. Police quickly began to close in, but Talik's supporters pulled his friend back before he could be arrested. Another supporter demanded that the crowd remain calm.
We will do this the right way, even though it is done wrong. We will do this the right way. Chill, okay?
Another dramatic moment when Talik's grandmother left the courtroom crying in the middle of the sentencing and almost fainted outside. An ambulance pulled up to check her out, but she was not taken away. Eventually, the verdict was returned.
LP.
The shooters had received the maximum sentence for involuntary manslaughter, 11 years and 16 years respectively. The family of Taliq seemed as satisfied as they could be, considering the circumstances. If you'd like to see photos from all of this outside of the courtroom, do a Facebook search for Chromatic Photography. That's K-R-O-M-A-T-I-C, Chromatic Photography. That's all we got time for today. We want to thank you for listening to Weekly Sedition and for listening to WRIR. It's 97.3, your Richmond Independent Radio. Take care and stay tuned.
I don't want no computer chip in my arm. I don't wanna die by a nuclear bomb. I say we all rush the Pentagon, pull out guns and grab the intercom. My first words would be, I believe man made God out of ignorance and fear. If God made man, then why the hell would he put us here? I thought he's supposed to be the all-loving, the same God who let Hitler put the Jews in the ovens. We don't fall for the regular shit. They try to feed us all this half-ass leadership, flipping position. They turn politician and shut the hell up and follow tradition. Boy, your TV screen is telling lies to your vision. Every channel got some brainwashed cops to watch, running up in niggas' cribs, claiming that they earn shots. It's a plot, but Buster, can you tell me who's greedier? The big corporations, the pigs, or the media? Sign of the times, terrorism on the rise. Commercial airplanes falling out the skies like flies. Make me wonder what secrets went down with Ron Brown, who burned the churches to the ground with no evidence found. It's not coincidence, it's been too many steady incidents. It could have been the Klan who put that bomb at the Olympics, but it probably was the FBI deep at the core. Cause if they make us all panic, they can start martial law. I don't believe Bob Marley died from cancer. 31 years ago I would have been a panther. They killed Huey cause they knew he had the answer. The views that you see in the news is propaganda. I don't believe Bob Marley died from cancer. 31 years ago I would have been a panther. You killed Huey cause you knew he had the answer. The views that you see in the news is motherfucking propaganda.